My name is Dorothy. Today's date is August 24th, and I'm speaking with Peter Engler. We are recording this in New Jersey. How old were you when the Holocaust started?
The Holocaust started officially in 1988, four.
So you were 4 years old. Did you know what was happening when it started?
We lived in a Jewish neighborhood, mm-hmm. in an apartment building, and on the ground floor were some shops, some Jewish shops, whose windows were all smashed on Kristallnacht.
Mm-hmm.
They were all smashed. Of course, I cannot remember it, but for many years, even as an adult, I had an abnormal reaction to the sound of broken glass.
What was your reaction?
Just a terror. It was just plain terror. Something snapped in me. Mm-hmm. I was in graduate school and in a lab, and somebody would break a beaker. And there were times I would have to go in the bathroom and sit down and put my head down and get my act back together again. I never knew what it was.
Do you think it was because of the night?
Well, yeah. Later on I needed psychological problems, and I had to go to a professional. And this individual analyzed it or did not rule it out that it is possible. That it is possible that even as a child, you can get what's now called PTSD. Even as a four-year-old kid, you can record an uncomfortable experience and that it would remain there.
So it was trauma.
Yeah, today we would call it post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay, thank you. I already asked. How did you feel when you grew older and this was still happening? Like, the Holocaust was still happening and concentration camps were still going.
You know, I was your age.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was your age. No, when I was your age, the war had ended. But you learn to live with the circumstances. It's not something that just happened. You just learn to live with it. We didn't talk about it an awful lot. You heard about, of course, there was no TV. We heard our parents talk about it. They didn't tell us about what's going on. But, of course, we overheard our parents talk. And somehow subconsciously, we were always living under fear because we didn't know what tomorrow would bring.
When you were living in fear, did you ever imagine it ever being over?
No, that's it. We had no idea whether and when it might be over.
And what was your reaction when it finally ended?
That's hard to describe. The joy. I've got to go back and tell some anecdotes. The first atomic bomb was dropped on August the 6th, 1945. We heard that something big had happened, but had no idea what it was, of course. We were not allowed out to be out in the street in the evening. But in the evening, my father suggested let's go out into the street and peek out into the street to see if we were occupied by the Japanese,
mm-hmm.
whether there were still any Japanese military on the street. And just as we lived at the end of a long lane,
mm-hmm.
not so long, 50 meters or so. We stuck our head out, and just as I stuck our head out, there was a Japanese officer on the sidecar of a motorcycle coming around the corner. And of course, we started running back home. And the last thing I saw, he was struggling to get up in this on the moving on the sidecar of this moving motorcycle, and reaching for a sidearm for his weapon. Of course, we ran back, and as we ran, I never saw my father run so fast before nor since. I heard him discharging his gun. Whether he was trying to shoot at us or no, I have no idea. I certainly didn't hear any bullets or anything. But that is not very reassuring for a 10-year-old kid.
Mm.
It does, and you wonder, when will this end?
And when you celebrated your bar mitzvah, was the war over?
Yes.
Okay.
The war ended on, officially Japan surrendered to the United States on the battleship, I don't know, Minnesota or Missouri, I don't know what that is, to MacArthur, to General MacArthur. That was on September the 15th, 1945, when officially the Japanese declared that that they were surrendering but they were still controlling the ghetto that we lived in. By military law, an occupying force has to keep control of the territory that they've just abandoned and keep order in the control. But they were not allowed to be they were allowed to carry weapons, but no ammunition in them. So we did know, I didn't notice, but somebody pointed out, the Japanese no longer had bayonets. The bayonets were gone. But then it took a while for us to realize that we no longer needed to be afraid. We had to wait. It was a few days later after the surrender, and I don't know, I can't remember the date. The Japanese overnight disappeared. There was not a single Japanese military man to be seen. They just vanished. How they managed to do that, I have no idea. And one or two days later, the American Navy, primarily the Navy, well, first the, again, I gotta step back. When the, when the Japanese surrendered, the American Air Force flew over quite low over the ghetto, and they were B-17 airplanes, and a white smoke came out of the back of these airplanes, and when I say we, of course, primarily our parents.
Yeah.
I was in 45. I was 11 years old. A white smoke came out, and our parents were very concerned because we didn't know what that white smoke was. We knew that what gas had been used for in Europe, and somebody even, and we couldn't even, these airplanes, we weren't even sure that these were American airplanes. When they had bombed us fairly regularly before the war was over, but they were so high up, even if we knew the insignia, we didn't know whether that they were American airplanes. We didn't know what they looked like, the under the wings that identified the airplanes. And some people even suggested that they were Russian airplanes. But it turned out later that the smoke that was coming out was a disinfectant. I don't know if you heard of it, DDT. No longer, you're not allowed to use it anymore, but it was a disinfectant that they used on, they even used in the concentration camps to disinfect, to de-louse the victims. Even in concentration camps, they had the DDT in hand-driven pumps and all the survivors in concentration camps were deloused. And this was was meant to delouse us. And then a few hours later, the airplanes came over again, this time flying a lot higher, and they dropped military food rations, cartons that were used for the soldiers, that were distributed to the soldiers. And that was the first time one of these cartons happened to drop near our house, so we got a hold of one of these cartons, the first one. And I can remember the four ingredients was there were tons of chewing gum.
Chewing gum.
Chewing gum.
Okay.
Very nutritious.
Tons of chewing gum. A coffee pot that my mom commandeered.
Okay.
And powdered milk.
I
remember. I remember these things. And of course, cans of all kinds of military rations, food.
Including spam.
Including spam.
And it's
still available.
I know it's big in like Hawaii, I think.
Big here.
To this day, I love this stuff.
Oh, God, really?
I say
it's my first exposure to something. Before that, our
that's what's the only food that you saw? Like, you'd love it.
Yes, of course.
I mean, some people
still eat it. It's relatively
affordable.
Yeah.
But there's an awful lot of salt in it.
It's toxic, in effect. It really is.
Well,
it really is.
I'm sure if it's like that, it might taste good, but it wouldn't be good for you.
Well, we'll give it to the homeless.
Anyway, we're going off script.
Oh, well,
we're going off script.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Well,
resume.
Dorothy, resume or finish or...
I know,
whatever.
We got very off topic.
Where were we?
Well, thank you for your experience and talking. Thank you for talking.
I have no trouble talking.
Thank you.
Okay, very good.